Just a short word about the handouts. There are some places where I talk about my deviations from the standard English translation of the passage I'll be discussing. So I thought it would be more comfortable for you to have a few sentences where you can see the original that I'm arguing with. It would be more easier for you to follow. I'll refer to them when they're relevant. Okay, so I'm going to talk about this like sort of shortened version of a paper that I'm writing for Professor Surabji's publication. So I'm leaving some of the stuff out. If you feel that there's something missing in the discussion, just tell me and during the discussion and tell me so maybe I would be able to elaborate. And if I don't know how to answer it, I'll just ask Professor Surabji to do it for me. Okay, so Themistius, who was active in the 4th century, was a philosopher and politician in the royal court of Constantinopolis. Surviving 4 different emperors in the court, his political activity is well documented in his surviving orations. But before becoming a professional politician, he was an active philosopher, a third generation of an idiosyncratic tradition continuing the legacy of his grandfather and father, none of whom belonged to any of the established schools. As Robert Todd remarks, his philosophical paraphrases of Aristotle are, I quote, "unusually free from scholasticism, reflecting the intellectual independence of an aristocrat whose involvement with teaching was a relatively brief prelude to a public career and not a lifelong professional commitment." Okay, so the paraphrases from which he is known in the Aristotelian tradition are rather strange creatures, including anything from direct quotations to lengthy departures from the text. It is not surprising that there is little scholarly agreement about what his positions actually were, and the attempts to pinpoint his affinity to the established schools, such as Peripateticism or Neoplatonism, prompted even more debate, most of which focused on his paraphrase of Aristotle's De Anima, his most studied work. Okay, now, unlike the De Anima paraphrase, Themistius's paraphrase of Aristotle's Metaphysics 12 has received little attention in scholarly literature, despite its unique place in the history of philosophy as the only complete surviving work on Metaphysics 12 from antiquity. The paraphrases's ill fate in modern scholarship is mostly due to the sorry fact that the original Greek text is lost. Fragments of Ishaq ibn Hunayn's 9th-century Arabic translation of the work survive in different forms, most of which have been published in one way or another, but it's a huge mess. Luckily, we possess the complete Hebrew translation made from the Arabic by the accomplished translator and philosopher Moshe ibn Tibbon in 1255. This was published as part of the CAG series, along with a 16th-century Latin translation made from the Hebrew. This state of play poses many challenges and problems for us when trying to establish the text and understand what Themistius is actually saying beyond his own specific peculiarities. Now, I will not be talking systematically about these issues here. That's tomorrow's talk. But instead, using some tools and sources that haven't been used yet, I'll attempt to understand the portion of Themistius' text that perhaps received the most scholarly attention, not that there's much competition, namely his discussion of spontaneous generation in the context of Aristotle's critique of the Platonic ideas. I think that some of the key points of Themistius' discussion have been misunderstood because of textual problems, which I'll attempt to solve here. Now, when I talk about spontaneous generation, I mean the coming to be of an organism out of something that's not co-specific to it, like mud or spoiled wine. Okay? So, this phenomenon, which obviously being fictitious, is perhaps totally irrelevant to modern biology, but it was taken very seriously in ancient and medieval times. Many accounts of it survives in different texts and for different purposes. Now, the importance of Themistius' account of spontaneous generation has been asserted by the groundbreaking and valuable work of Devin Henry, whose analysis of Themistius' challenge to Aristotelian biology, as well as the response he offers on Aristotle's behalf, has become a standard point of reference and is integrated in subsequent studies on spontaneous generation in ancient and medieval philosophy. A revised version of Henry's paper is going to be published soon. Now, up until now, everyone who studies Themistius' discussion relied on a lengthy quotation of the Arabic translation of Themistius, supplied by a very unsympathetic Averroes in his long commentary on Aristotle's Metaphysics. The passage has been translated into English in Charles Genecon's translation of Averroes' long commentary, and a revised version is also available in Professor Sorabji's source book on the commentators. So I think it's safe to say that it's the most read passage from Themistius' paraphrase of Metaphysics Lambda. Now, working with Averroes' quotation rather than the Hebrew version is justified to a certain extent, since Averroes' Arabic quotation is less removed from the Greek original than the Hebrew translation, which was obviously made from the Arabic. But you can't really base yourself solely on the Arabic for two reasons. First, we only have one manuscript of Averroes' text, and there are a few places where it is corrupt or illegible. So the Hebrew should really help us to establish what Averroes is doing. Another, non less important consideration is that Averroes' quote is removed from its original context within Themistius' paraphrase, without which it is impossible to offer a complete understanding of his argument. One doesn't get the function of the text within the paraphrase, neither does one get enough vocabulary to tackle the more difficult Arabic passages. Now, a systematic philological analysis of all the surviving evidence in Arabic and Hebrew points to a refined reading of some key points of the text, which have significant bearings on the understanding of it. I'll note the most important ones in the course of the discussion, and I hope you won't find it too tedious. So here's what I plan to do. Okay, first, I'll present Themistius' reconstruction of Aristotle's argument against the existence of Platonic ideas in Metaphysics 12, chapter 3, and show how it lays the foundation for a concept of coming to be that excludes the parent from being an active agent in the process of begetting. This will give us much needed context that we didn't have in scholarship until now, because just no one studied this part of the paraphrase before. After that, the main part of my talk will offer a fresh analysis of Themistius' discussion of spontaneous generation in light of the argument against the ideas he brings forth on Aristotle's behalf. So as I said earlier, I'll present a new interpretation of some of its key arguments. By the time we're done, I'm sure that a lot of open questions will remain. So in the final part, which I hope will lead to some discussions, I'll do some speculating. Okay, that's where I'll become very irresponsible. I'll try to be responsible until that point, but from that point on, I'll be very irresponsible. So you can slap me on the hand if you want. Okay, so Aristotle's Metaphysics 12, chapter 3 concludes with a condensed argument that supposedly rejects the need for Platonic ideas in coming to be, as Aristotle already believes that there are sufficient principles to explain coming to be without them. Now I quote, this is your text one in your handout. Evidently then, there is no necessity, on this ground at least, for the existence of ideas. For man is begotten by man, a given man by an individual father, and similarly in the arts, for the medical art is the formal cause of health. Okay, so this is very condensed, and it's hard to find an argument here. Now, of course, Aristotle is calling back to previous discussions, but I'm less interested in Aristotle and more with what Themistius does with him. Now, in the paraphrase, and this part we only have in Hebrew, Themistius replaces Aristotle's brief remark with a much more detailed argument, which is reminiscent of Aristotle's elaborate discussions in Metaphysics Zeta 7 to 9. Now, this is the argument that we should be analyzing, okay? Because this is what Themistius directly responds to in the fragment that Averroes is quoting, which, as I've mentioned, is the starting point of all modern scholarship on Themistius' view. So I just put the Aristotle quotation so you can see what Themistius is replacing. Okay, I won't discuss it. Now, in text 2, you'll find a translation of the argument Themistius supplies on behalf of Aristotle, which I break into sections for the sake of convenience. So I'll read it now, and I apologize for the very non-elegant translation. It's very, very literal. Okay, but that's for the moment the best I can do, so I apologize again. So he writes, one, But if the form that had existed prior to its successor is the agent for the formation of that, i.e. the posterior form, so that man is indeed created from man, and a horse is indeed created from a horse, and in every case the particular from particular, for the universal does not beget and is not begotten, but that which begets and is begotten is indeed a this and a that, what need do we have then, in the context of coming to be, for the ideas Plato had talked about? Second part of the argument. And what need does the begetting form have for the other form, i.e. the Platonic idea, as a model for it, given that it itself is the model for what is created from it? For the name and the definition will be common to both, and their form is one, and it is of the nature of the begetting form that it beget another form just like it. And the final part of the argument, I quote, and we find that art does not need a separate form to be set up as a model for it in anything it does, so that, for example, when it aims to make a chair, it would not be able to make it without the aid of a model. For art in itself is the model for the chair, because the form of the chair stands in the mind of the carpenter who makes it, just as medicine is the form of health and masonry is the form of the house. Okay, so as a critique of the Platonic ideas, this seems compelling, and Themistius sets up for himself a challenge considerably more serious than Aristotle's laconic closing statements of chapter 3. Now, if we look at the argument, we can see that each of its three parts addresses a different function of the Platonic ideas and shows that we can supply it without them. So, and it's distributed among the different parts. So you can see that parts 1 and 2 deal with natural coming to be, while part 3 deals with artificial things. And then you see that part 1 criticizes Platonic ideas as active principles, while parts 2 and 3 criticize Platonic ideas as external models according to which things come to be. Part 1 addresses the possibility of the Platonic idea as the active principle in the process of begetting of living things, and shows that there is no need for them, assuming that the parent already occupies this function. Part 2 denies the need for Platonic ideas as external models according to which living things are begotten, since the shared definition of maker and made, and obviously the shared form, are sufficient to show that the individual form is its own model. Part 3 denies the need for Platonic ideas as models according to which the arts do their work, since artisans act according to the form of the product already present in their mind. Okay, chair, health, house. Now, when we turn to Themistius' immediately following discussion, which is where spontaneous generation is introduced, we'll see that he does not respond to the argument in its entirety. He offers no defense against part 3 of the argument and defends against only some of part 2. Some of his attention is devoted to the Aristotelian claim that an individual form like this man serves as a model for its offspring, also claimed in part 2 of the argument, by introducing spontaneous generation as a counterexample which proves that sameness of definition, man begets man, and the shared form are not necessary conditions for coming to be. Finally, Themistius will completely reject the premise of part 1, which is not accidentally constructed as a conditional statement. Themistius will try to show that the prior existing individual form, this man, is not and cannot be the active formative principle in the coming to be of its offspring, because the act of reproduction is simply an act of one body upon another, and this interaction by itself is insufficient for determining the form of its outcome. The result of Themistius's defense will not be a reinstating of Plato's ideas, but rather a corroboration of the need to appeal to a principle beyond the individual parent, as well as to a cause higher than nature, in order to provide an acceptable account of coming to be. But more about that later. So let's turn to Themistius' independent discussion of spontaneous generation, which you can find in T3, divided into shorter passages. Okay, I'm not going to read all of it, but I am going to read most of it, but not at the same time. Okay. So Themistius opens his discussion by providing a counterexample to Aristotle's argument, enumerating types of animals that do not come to be from their co-species. So now I'm quoting from part one of T3. This argument is persuasive for denying the Platonic ideas, but its author neglected the plurality of animals that are created by things different from their like, i.e. their co-species, in spite of their great number. Now, if you look at the other handout, you can see the translation by Jeannequin, which is different, especially the first part when he says, where I have is persuasive, he has would be sufficient. Okay? So, the Arabic term we have here, I'm talking mostly about the Arabic when I have it because the Hebrew usually reflects the Arabic. The Arabic term mukni is most likely a translation of the Greek pithanon, but I won't get into all of the evidence I have for that here. Now, when I talked to this about Professor Sarabji, he remarked that in the present tradition, a persuasive argument is not necessarily true. Yeah. So this point is more important than one might think, because if you read the sentence like Jeannequin's would be sufficient, we could have theoretically said that if there were no spontaneously generated animals, Aristotle's critique would hold, because because then we wouldn't have this counterexample. But Themistius, as we'll see, wants to go beyond that and claim that that Aristotle's argument doesn't hold regardless of the specific example of spontaneous generation. So for Themistius, spontaneous generation is not the core of the argument, but a phenomenon that directs our attention to an even more basic problem in Aristotle's critique. Okay, so now Themistius proceeds to list some examples of spontaneous generation, most of which were common in ancient times: hornets from dead horses, bees from dead cattle, and other fun stuff like that. The important thing about these examples is that they are meant to show that spontaneous generation is an orderly phenomenon. The point that Themistius is making is that spontaneous generation is an integral part of the course of nature, and therefore every account of generation which aspires to be complete must take it into consideration. So that's why that's the first reason why spontaneous generation is a serious challenge for Aristotle's critique. Now, the correspondence between cause and effect in each class of spontaneous generation will soon play an important part in the fundamental underlying distinction between the formative principle and the physical interaction upon which Themistius' own concept of coming to be will build. But for the moment, it will suffice to say that Themistius is describing a natural, orderly, and regular rather than accidental phenomenon. He continues. This is part two of text three. And we know that in the sperm and in the seed of every single animal and plant, there is a logos, nisba in Arabic, or yahas, proper to it, by which are begotten these animals and plants, which are begotten from it specifically and not from another, so that neither does a horse come to be from the sperm of a man, nor a man from the sperm of a horse, nor a plant for the seed of another plant. Okay, so here Themistius introduces to the discussion a notion of logos, which is described here as something that inheres in the sperm or the seed and ensures a correspondence within species between the parent's seed and its offspring. I won't get too much into history here, but this account of logos doesn't seem to easily relate to any known account that survives from the Platonic and Neoplatonic traditions, and Professor Sarabji would be the expert about that. Themistius clearly doesn't think that they are transcendent Platonic ideas, so he can't be subject to the criticism Middle Platonic philosophers suffered for confusing between logoi and ideas. But they have to have something to do with forms, given the context of the discussion and the fact that they're specific to every species. Themistius' own characterization of logos is a something that makes sure that nature doesn't get things wrong. In other words, Themistius is trying to show that the logos has something to do with the uniformity of nature as a proper correspondence between a given material arrangement and a given substantial effect. Each of these logoi is proper to a certain species. Having said that, Themistius proceeds to search for the logos within the process of spontaneous generation, because up until now we talked about logos in co-specific generation. This is another part where I argue with Jeannequin's translation. So he asked, where are the counterparts of these logoi, i.e. the logoi in the sperm and the seed, in that from which this, the spontaneously generated animal, is begotten? Unless a suitable logos had been put in nature previously, ready to create any possible animal species, having found proper matter for creating a certain animal from it, it, i.e. the spontaneously generated animal, wouldn't have been brought into actuality. Okay, so sorry for this, but we have no choice but to look at some of the textual problems here, because this is the key point of the text and has serious bearings on the understanding of the argument. So until now, what I read as counterpart in the first part of the quotation, Arabic Nazil, was understood as model, which gave the text a flavor of perhaps, if there's something like that, orthodox Platonism, as if there are some sort of transcendent paradigms somehow transformed into logoi, or something like that. Now, my analysis of the sources leads me to conclude that the original Greek had analogos, and that's why I read counterparts. It also makes more sense, because Themistius know where the logoi of co-specific generated organisms are, in the sperm and in the seed. And so now he asks where the logoi of spontaneous generated animals are. So there's no new metaphysical element in the discussion yet. Now, another point is that Jeannequin's translation of the present passage omits the use of the term matter here. And this is extremely important because it explains that logoi work on proper matter, matter when it is arranged, conditioned properly. So when matter is organized in a certain way, the logos is responsible for creating the organism, or if we may, make sure that it has the right form. And finally, and this is not Jeannequin's fault, the final words of the sentence are not quoted in Averroes. He just missed a couple of words, but we can't find them in the Hebrew. And they subsequently make the text very different, because if you compare both versions, you'll see that they change both the syntax and the meaning of the sentence. So, on my reading, we learn that the logoi play a crucial part in the actualization of organisms. This wasn't in Averroes' quotation. I'll come back later to this point and try to understand with you how this actually works. So, the question Themistius is asking here can only make sense if we fully realize that in spontaneous generation, the relation between cause and effect is not accidental. Seeking the place of logoi within nature for spontaneous generated animals suggests that in principle, the fact that putrescence begets frogs rather than hornets should be awarded the same explanation as the fact that human sperm begets human beings rather than horses. In other words, Themistius widens the scope of the logoi so as to include all possible cases of coming to be in the natural world, suggesting that they are prior to the individuals, and I quote, had been put in nature previously. So the logos is the formative agent that determines what species of animals matter will be fashioned into once it is organized in a certain manner. So just as animals that are begotten by their co-species come to be according to a specific logos inhering in the seed or the sperm that ensures that they're of the same species as their parents, spontaneously generated animals which are begotten by specific material causes in nature must also come to be according to a specific logos inhering in nature that ensures that they, rather than a different species, are begotten from it. Now, if Themistius is right, one must relinquish the idea promoted in part two of the argument he put forth on Aristotle's behalf, namely that shared definition and shared form, man begets man, are sufficient to exhibit the causal role of the parent in determining the form of its offspring. This can no longer be maintained, not only because there are cases in which the begetter has nothing in common with the begotten, but also, as we shall immediately see, because the parent has no role in determining the form of its offspring. Themistius then takes a very big step forward and claims that scientific explanation of coming to be should actually start with spontaneous generation, employing an analogy with artistry to clarify his point. And I'm quoting, this is from part four. "Do not be deceived by contempt for these animals, but reflect that they fill us with admiration toward the artisan. The skill he exhibits by making something out of clay is greater than the skill he exhibits by making something out of gold and ivory. If you examine carefully what happens with animals bigger than that, than spontaneously generated animals, you will find that nature proceeds there exactly in the same way." Now, this is not just a poetic remark. Themistius is actually offering a restatement of Aristotle's justification for study of inferior animals in his Parts of Animals. And I'm quoting, you have it in the footnote, where Aristotle says, "For even in the study of animals disagreeable to perception, the nature that crafted them likewise provides extraordinary pleasures to those who are able to know their causes and are by nature philosophers. For this reason, we should not be childishly disgusted at the examination of the less valuable animals. For in all natural things, that there is something marvelous." I'll just say on a side note that when you see medieval Arabic and Hebrew commentaries on the Book of Animals, you see that philosophers who read Themistius' paraphrase just take that bit from the Metaphysic paraphrase and insert it in the proper context of the Book of Animals. Okay, so they actually find it, they actually located its natural home. Okay, so that's how the medievals read this passage. Okay, so instead of Aristotle's philosophical pleasure of examining the marvel of natural phenomena, Themistius offers admiration of the artisan's skill. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about this in the discussion, but I think that the artisan Themistius is talking about here is in fact God. We'll talk about it later, maybe. Coming back to the present discussion, Themistius is saying that since this skill is greater exhibited in spontaneously generated animals, an examination of them will actually provide us with better understanding of coming to be. From the point of view of natural inquiry, Themistius is implying that Aristotle had it the wrong way around. Instead of devising a theory about coming to be based on code-specific begetting and then seeing how, if at all, spontaneous generation fits within it, one should start with spontaneous generation, which requires more skill on the part of the artisan, and only then proceed to easier examples. In other words, man begets man camouflages what is actually going on. So Themistius proceeds to explain exactly how co-specific coming to be is analogous to spontaneous generation, demonstrating that ultimately the father who begets his son has no causal advantage over the dead cattle from which bees are begotten, effectively rejecting part one of the argument he presented on behalf of Aristotle and necessitating an appeal to pre-existing logoi. And I quote, this is part five. "It is necessary for there to exist logoi in forms that have been put into nature upon which it works its work. For even if man is indeed begotten by man, the father exerts no artistry in his composition of this, which cannot be in another state better than the state he is in. He arrives at the state because the logoi and forms had been put into nature of each of the substances, not by means of artistry on the part of the father, but from the logoi. The body doesn't work on another body, except only on its surface, whereas nature works on the corporeality of the body in its entirety." Now, note the formula logoi and forms. You see it here and you'll see it in other places too. I think that this, the and, the chi, the Greek chi here, should be taken as epexegetic. That's how you say it?
Cool. Yes.
Yeah. We also find this use of the car in Themistius in other places, in the orations, for instance. But this is an open question. So, for Themistius, the fact that man begets man does not mean that man is the formative agent of his offspring. First, it is obvious that there's no artistry involved here because man proceeds from man naturally, regardless of what the parent has in mind. This is, of course, obvious in any other animal. Now, second, the man begets man example actually exhibits the shortcoming of co-specific generation when compared to spontaneous generation, because in the former case, the offspring is just like the parent, while in the latter case, the effect, for instance, frog, is better than the cause, for instance, putrescence. So spontaneous generation also shows us that the individual form cannot serve as the model for its offspring, because in spontaneous generation, the parent and the offspring are completely different from each other. So in all of the cases, we have to appeal to a different formative agent, which is the logos. It is important to note that this agent is immanent in nature. This is not something transcended, but it is prior to the individual. It still is in the natural world, but it has been put in nature. Okay, this is what Themistius says. But Themistius goes even further than that. In the final sentence of the quotation, he seems to be saying that an appeal to prior logoi would have been necessary even if all coming into be were co-specific. This leads us back to the argument, if the argument was sufficient or persuasive. I talked about this in the beginning. So Themistius asserts that the body doesn't work on another body except only on its surface, whereas nature works on the corporeality of the body in its entirety. The bodily interactions that result in the generation of a new living being cannot by themselves determine its form, because the form has to do with the entire body, whereas physical interaction is limited to the body's external surface. Some other principle should be responsible for the form of the product of this interaction, and it can only come from nature, whose action upon the body is comprehensive. In Arabic and Hebrew, it's kind of a funny construction, the complete bodiness of the body, or fi jusmat al jism, something. It's pretty amusing. Anyway, okay. So there must be in nature logoi, which are in a way prior to individual substances. The form cannot be simply transmitted from one individual to another, but co-specific generation renders this more difficult to uncover. If we return to the original argument Themistius advanced against the ideas on Aristotle's behalf, we can take these remarks to object to part one, which was the form that had existed prior to its successor is the agent for the formation of the posterior form. Having affirmed the existence of logoi in nature that are prior to the individuals, although not transcendent, it is time to ask how they work. Themistius first denies that nature itself is the ultimate cause, despite its comprehensive ability. And I quote, and this is from part 6. And no wonder that nature does not understand the movement of its work toward the end aimed at, since it does not know and does not think about the work it does. This shows you that these logoi have been inspired by a cause nobler, worthier, and higher in rank than themselves, i.e. the soul in the earth, which Plato thought had been created by the secondary gods, and Aristotle thought had been created by the sun and the ecliptic. Therefore, it, meaning nature, does its work and advances toward the end without understanding the end, just as inspired people talk and foretell the future without understanding themselves what they say. So this passage is very charged from a historical point of view, and it's not very easy to trace what Themistius is meaning either in Plato or in Aristotle, but I will not be talking about this here, maybe in the discussion, because I want to focus on the argument. If we have time in the discussion, maybe I can elaborate. So what Themistius says is that although it is within nature's power to act upon a body as a whole, we cannot see it as the cause that actualizes the logoi, which have been put in it, since nature is an unconscious agent and cannot determine the end toward which it acts. The cause that directs the logoi toward the end aimed at is some sort of soul in the earth, and it does it by means of some sort of inspiration. So, Themistius explains neither what the soul of the earth is, nor what inspiration is. We know that the function of the soul of the earth is to actualize the logoi, so we can take it to be some independent principle of life without getting into too much trouble. But what is this inspiration we're talking about? So James Wilberding, in his paper about spontaneous generation in the Neoplatonic tradition, finds similarity between what Themistius is describing here and a process described in Porphyry, where the verb empnein, to inspire, is used to describe, and I quote, the mother's actualization of the logoi in the seed embryo. Wilberding suggests that if we accept an analogy between the soul in the earth and the mother, empnein would mean to actualize the logoi and set them in motion. So, is this what Themistius has in mind? Wilberding, in fact, has shown me in a personal correspondence that Themistius uses the same technical term for inspiration in his De Anima paraphrase, again in the context of spontaneous generated animals, which I quote from Themistius, simultaneously with the coming to be of the blending, immediately receive inspiration, are alive, and are self-moved. So without getting too philological, I think that the Arabic verb ulhimat in Averroes' quotation can very well be a translation of empneitai. Again, I'll save you all the reasons for that. I'll just note that ilham, which in the Arabic tradition is understood as an instant of divine inspiration aimed at a specific individual, serves as a rather adequate analogy to Wilberding's understanding of empneistai as a specific instance of actualizing the logoi and setting them to motion. And both terms work whether we're talking about prophecy, which is the counterpart of the analogy, or whether we're talking about something more technically metaphysical. Okay, so I have a very long defense of how this came to be, but I won't bother you with that unless you're really bored. Okay, so in short, I would like to suggest that inspiration is a specific instance of actualizing the logoi and setting them to motion. This would clarify Themistius' earlier description of the function of logoi. This was at part 3 of the third text, when it quote that the logoi are ready to create any possible animal species, having found proper matter for creating a certain animal from it. In the medieval philosophy, by the way, theories of prophecy are sometimes described as exactly the same. When the material intellect is organized in a certain way, in Hebrew it's called Hachanata Mekabel. I don't remember how it is. So the recipient is ready to be inspired directly to get the prophetic message. So this is something analogical to that. Okay, so the soul of the earth itself, as a moving principle and the final cause, is the product of an even higher cause, of whose origin Plato and Aristotle offered different explanations according to Themistius. Plato thinks that the secondary gods are responsible for it, while Aristotle ascribes it to the sun and the ecliptic. As I said, getting into this historical aspect of this discussion is beyond my scope, at least for the time I'm talking. So, while Themistius' explanation here leaves much to be desired and keeps us in the dark regarding his immediate philosophical sources, there are three important things that can be gathered from the text. First, Themistius stresses on more than one occasion that the logoi have been put into nature. And this implies that although they exist in the sperm and in the seed, in a way their existence can be seen as independent from the individual substances. This is why recourse to spontaneous generation is important, and ultimately what makes the difference between Themistius' explanation and Aristotle's standard account. Second, Themistius' appeal to the soul in the earth a higher principle than nature shows that for him, nature's unconsciousness renders it unfit to be the source of its own teleological activity. The telos should be supplied from without, and the ontological link between the soul and the earth and the metaphysical realm perhaps suggests some sort of divine involvement, which is hinted at but never explained. I'm leaning toward this understanding, but it requires more work. And finally, Themistius' insistence on ascribing the soul in the earth to Aristotle as well as to Plato, and I think and actually neither of them holds a position like that, suggests that he is advocating harmony between the two instead of simply defending Plato and rejecting Aristotle. So Themistius concludes, and this is the last part of text 3. In short, it is impossible for them not to exist in nature, logoi and forms. See the formula again, logoi and forms. Since otherwise, a thing would need its like in order to be begotten, and not everything that is begotten has a like from which it is begotten. But when we inquire into a certain individual form from which a certain actuality arises, we know that it, i.e. the actuality, is not created only by it, i.e. the individual form. This form, I mean the actualized form, then, is created as if it had been latent in something else, and it is fully latent in the begetting nature. Okay, so if you compare this to Jenikon's translation, you'll see a huge difference. That's because the text here, the Arabic and the Hebrew, it's a complete mess. And I reconstructed it from scratch from all sorts of sources. And maybe I'll show it would be pretty difficult now. Okay, so to sum up, Themistius believes that he has shown that the existence of logo is absolutely necessary. And he seems to equate them with forms, although doesn't explain how, but somewhat clumsily reverts the terminology of the discussion back from logo to forms. The counterexample of spontaneous generation can be expanded to the totality of living beings, the reproduction of which is impossible to explain without positing logoi as formative principles immanent in nature that supply the proper formal component to the causal interaction between bodies which lead to coming to be of new individuals. Each instance of this process is actualized by inspiration from the soul and the earth, a final cause that is ontologically linked to the metaphysical realm. Having discussed Themistius' presentation of Aristotle's critique of the Platonic ideas and his own critical response to it, we find ourselves in a somewhat awkward position. Granted, Themistius introduces a concept of logoi that has somehow been put into unconscious nature and are actualized, inspired by the soul in the earth, itself a product either of the secondary gods, Plato, or the sun and the ecliptic, Aristotle. But after all, assuming that the mystic's defense against Aristotle's critique is successful, we are left with this, with just that, an appeal to logoi and to a higher final cause in coming to be. Nothing is actually said about Plato's transcendent ideas, which were the reason for the discussion in the first place. The metaphysical framework that Themistius offers stops with the soul in the earth as the agent of logoi, and after a few concluding remarks, he returns to straightforward paraphrasing, starting afresh with Metaphysics 12, Chapter 4. So, perhaps we should look elsewhere in Themistius' text for the Platonic ideas. One of Themistius' most noteworthy interpretive moves in his paraphrase is to understand Aristotle's assertion that God intellects himself as meaning that God intellects all of the intelligibles. This, for Themistius, implies a fundamental identity between God and the existence. This is most obvious in the statement that is not in your handout, but it's short. That which is them is he, and that which is he is his intelligibles. And Carlos will talk about that statement tomorrow. But in the following passage, and this is text 4, Themistius seems to go further and equate the intelligibles with forms. And I quote, "The divine intellect is intellect and intelligible at once. Unlike the sense, which is not the same as a sensible when its, i.e. the latter's form, is imprinted, while its substance remains outside, the state of the intellect with the intelligibles is such that they belong to him substantially. For he carries all the forms, with no substance that is mixed with matter kept outside. For there is no matter there, but rather an abstract form that is unmixed with matter, which is attached to that which intellects it or thinks it, without being divided or having some of its parts drawn away from each other, as is the case of the sensibles with regard to the sense. For it is grounded in the intellect. The first divine intellect intellects the intelligibles that are existent in him and assumes their forms. It is tempting to understand this remark as effectively adopting a somewhat simplified version of ideas of thoughts of God. Now let me speculate a bit. If you remember, I said earlier that Themistius rejects only some of the critique he offers on Aristotle's behalf. Now, if we assume, and this is only an assumption, that he accepts the portions he doesn't defend against, then from a purely philosophical consideration, ideas as thoughts of God seem like a plausible result of the combination between the portions of Aristotle's critique that Themistius rejects and those that he doesn't reject. The rejection of Critique 1, which is reflected in the adoption of Logoi, seems to open the door for some sort of transcendent existence of ideas over and above the individuals. Since we are told that the Logoi have been put in nature, and after all, they are formative principles. However, in accordance with the portion of Critique 2, which Themistius does not reject, the ideas cannot be external models, so perhaps they should be somehow internalized. A possible solution can be found by employing the idea of God as artisan, Themistius talks about, and applying Aristotle's statements in Critique 3, which Themistius also does reject, to the natural world. Now, whether Themistius' God is an artisan or not is the subject of a completely different discussion. I think he is, and I think I can defend it, but not conclusively. So if you bear with me this far, so God, like any other artisan, does not act according to external models, but rather according to internal ideas already present in him. So this is very speculative and requires more work, but I think that with some effort I can show that it's at least plausible and will also connect different parts of Themistius' paraphrase and the metaphysics, not just the specific discussion I was referring to. But one can just as well maintain that in his discussion of God's thoughts, Themistius is putting to practice Aristotle's characterization of the intellect as the form for forms in the anima. So the question would be, is Themistius referring to Plato's ideas or to Aristotle's forms? If one is insistent upon finding some completion on Themistius' behalf in the form of a remnant of the ideas he defended earlier against Aristotle's critique, this is probably the place one should be looking for them. Alternatively, one could relinquish this attempt to fill this lacuna in Themistius' text and settle for Themistius being a good Aristotelian. But perhaps we don't have to decide. Whatever he originally meant, and this you can see other instances of this phenomenon in Themistius, Themistius would most likely allow the reader to take either side, or even both. Following the footsteps of Eugenius, his father and teacher, who was no stranger to harmonizing Plato and Aristotle, and I quote from the Orations, Themistius says about his father, "When passing from the academy to the Lyceum, he did not change his clothes. He would often first make a sacrifice to Aristotle and then end up by worshipping Plato. He always got angry at those who actually tried to build a dividing wall between the two sacred enclosures and to separate them." Thank you.